Nation.
I'm Megan Figueroa.
And I'm Carrie Gillen.
Hello.
Hello.
We are here.
We made it through February, which was a rough month for both of us.
Yes. It was very rough. I think it's been a rough month for a lot of people, if I've been reading Twitter correctly.
I mean, probably. It's been a rough year, so.
Yeah. But it's been rough, but I'm grateful I got my second dose of vaccine.
Yeah, you're almost fully vaxxed up.
Vaxxed up in a couple days. And then my dad got his.
Oh, good.
Yesterday, yeah. And still waiting on my mom's.
Basically, nobody here has been vaccinated outside of, like, the really high priority groups.
Yeah.
So...
I think about how these intros where we talk about coronavirus, they're going to be such a relic from the past in a couple of years. But it's going to be so interesting. It's like a time capsule of, I mean, this is our lives.
About it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because like about a year ago, I think we were talking about, hey, there's like the first case in Arizona.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no way that was actually true. That was probably the 100th case, maybe more.
We
just didn't know because it was circulating in December 2019.
Right.
And nobody knew.
Exactly. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see all of the ways that we talk about this in the future and what sources we use to kind of look back in time and see where we were at. It's kind of nice to have a podcast in that way.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's kind of like a diary.
It is. Dear listeners. Thanks for spending your pandemic with us.
Kind of speaking of all about this, last time we were talking about wet markets, and one of our listeners, Dr. Gerald Roche, sent us this blog post about the term, not just wet market, but definitely about wet markets and how wording matters.
Yes.
So it's called The Cultural Construction of the, quote, Bazaar, Disentangling Sinophobic Language in Media and Science During the COVID-19 Epidemic. And so we talked a lot about Sinophobia in our bonus episode that we just recorded. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested in that, you can find that on patreon.com/vocalfriespod. So it talks about things like the Wuhan virus, the Chinese virus, and how those are obviously extremely problematic framing of what really is SARS-CoV-2, but no one ever talks about that. We all just say COVID,
right?
Which is the disease, not the virus itself, but
yep.
Yeah, whatever. But a lot of the problem, or a lot of this blog post is really about the word wet market.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, some of the wet market, or what are called wet markets in the West, do have problems with handling animals and whatever. So, but I don't want to downplay that. But the wording wet market is still kind of problematic. So I always thought it was kind of gross.
Mm-hmm.
But then I read some stuff from some Asian Americans who were saying, well, actually, it's just the inverse of dry market, and I was, or dry goods store, and I was like, okay, so wet market isn't that bad after all, but it might still be kind of bad because it really does kind of like make you feel squicky, right? The word itself, wet market, right?
Like moist for some people,
like moist,
yeah.
So it is still like anti-Asian framing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know. It is an interesting article or blog post, and I'll put it in the links. So the literal translation of the word in Chinese, which I will not attempt to pronounce, just means street market. So really, street market would be probably a better translation, and would be totally fine, and wouldn't bring up all these kind of icky associations that we would have with wet market.
So would they use that same word for markets we would associate with dry goods? Does it say?
Yeah, so it seems like street markets, I think, can have like food, but they could also have goods like electronics and things like that. So it could be that like the Western world is putting this distinction on this category.
Mm-hmm.
You know, between like the foods and like non-foods, that they're not distinguishing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when I think of street market, I definitely think of all everything. Food and, you know, like, scarves and, you know, like, whatever.
Yeah.
Right? So, I don't know if what we're calling wet markets do lack all of that other stuff. Mm-hmm. And we're just, like, highlighting the ick factor. Or they're not like that, and we're forcing a distinction that's not there, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, which we probably are. Because I'm thinking, I mean, street market, you know, in other places, they're everywhere. I'm thinking about Mexico, and, you know, we have them in the U.S. too, but I feel like we somehow think that what we do is different.
Yeah, well, if I think of the United States, I mostly think of farmers markets.
Yeah, exactly.
Which are similar, but not quite as all-encompassing.
Right.
Like, it's a narrower band of things that get sold.
So usually, like, handcrafts, if you're selling goods in that way.
Handcrafts, soaps, things like that.
Yeah.
And then food.
Right. I guess I bring that up because I think a lot of times what Westerners do is make, point out differences in a way that, I want to say deficit. I've been thinking a lot about difference and deficit. But, you know, just, like, we have similar things or things that, you know, that we do that might be seen as disgusting to other people. Why are we in a unique place to call something disgusting or whatever?
Yeah. So blog post makes the argument that this distinction might actually have its roots in the colonization of these places by the British Empire in the 19th century. And this distinction between, like, wet markets and not wet markets, you know, you're associating wet with the blood of freshly slaughtered animals and also unsanitary storage packages, which is kind of true. I don't think I had, like, really gotten that far along in my, like, thinking about what it really meant. But I do think that it does evoke those things. Mm. And so I think just calling street markets is probably what I will do from now on.
Yeah, and as you learned last time when you mentioned this word to me, because we were talking about what words got entered into the new, or what Merriam-Webster just added to the dictionary, I had never heard of wet market. even in my readings about coronavirus and such, I had never come across it. So I had no association. So I didn't even associate it with blood or anything like that. So it wasn't really gross to me, or it's not gross to me.
Yeah, I don't think that it's inherently gross. Like, just something being wet is not necessarily gross. But I do think that because we're associating, you hadn't yet, because you didn't know, you know, these things existed. But, like, many Westerners are associating these markets with live animals, which are sold in some of them. Mm-hmm. That are freshly slaughtered right there in front of the customer. Like, that is a thing that happens, but still, like, it brings up blood and all these things that, you know, you don't like to think about very much. I hadn't thought about the excretions at all. Like, that, even though, like, the unsanitary way that some of them are, I don't know, like, put in cages and, like, mm-hmm. right there and on top of each other. Like, that does happen. But that also happens
in the U.S.
in the U.S. Like,
yeah.
Chicken farming is disgusting.
We just don't see it in the same way.
We don't see it. Like, you're not even allowed to film it anymore. There's a law against it in the States. It is so disturbing that they had to put a law in place so that people couldn't see how gross we treat our animals. So, you know, like, also, this is a temporary thing. They're temporarily kind of gross.
At the street markets.
Yeah, even though I don't think wet market is inherently gross on its own, we do have these associations, and I think using the term does kind of strengthen that association, so we should just stick to street market, because it does encompass everything that can get sold, and not just focusing on the animal, the products, which is just one part of what gets sold, so.
And it's important, because it's not that we're trying to, like, superimpose a word over what they call their markets. They actually call them street markets. So
they call them the equivalent of street market.
Yeah. So that's the important point too, because we wouldn't just want to start calling other people's stuff something else. But we already did that. We were the ones that called it wet market, or translated that way, or whatever.
Right.
So this is kind of going back to something that's more in line with what
closer,
they call it.
Closer to the original.
Yeah.
A better translation of the original.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I would like to thank Gerald for pointing that out to me, because I hadn't considered it, and it's true. It's the association is squicky. And I did have that in my head at first, and the only way I got rid of it was the, oh no, it's just the opposite of dry goods. And I was like, oh, okay, that's fine. I can reframe it that way. But I think this is an even better reframing. Let's just call them street markets.
Yeah. And who doesn't love a street market?
Oh my God.
I would love to go to a street market.
Anyway, yeah. So today's episode, we talk about queer and translation and interpretation.
Yeah, with friend of the pod, Artemis. Friend of the pod. Yes. Mm-hmm. So exciting.
Yeah, it's a really interesting episode. Mm-hmm. Definitely
learned
some things.
Me too. Exactly. Hope you do too.
Like this show and want to make your own? Let me tell you about Anchor. It's free, and they have creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And now you can even add any song from Spotify directly to your episodes. The possibilities are endless for what you can create, whether it's music analysis, your own radio show, or something the world's never heard before. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. And you can also make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
Artemis Lopez, who is a highly trained and certified translator and interpreter, a linguistics PhD student, and a longtime member of both English and Spanish-speaking queer, trans, and non-binary communities in the U.S. and in Spain. They have been translating and interpreting for these communities since 2011. Artemis now specializes in medical and queer translation and interpretation. Thank you so much for being here, Artemis.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So excited. We were just talking before we started about our kind of lives in isolation, and so you're in Spain right now, right?
Correct. I'm in Spain. I moved here about a year ago, a touch over a year ago. Times are very weird lately. So I moved here like November 2019 to do this PhD. Up until then, the 16 years before that, I was in DC, which is occupied Piscataway land. And I moved to Spain because I wanted to look at non-binary Spanish, which is what I'm doing my dissertation on, and I thought I really should go to a country that speaks Spanish in order to be researching this. There's a lot of Spanish in the US, but I feel like it's from a lot of different places, and there's a lot of immigration and movement, so it made sense to go to one place that has sort of static Spanish happening. And I actually happened to come over to Universidad de Vigo, which is in Galicia, and they speak Galician here, which is also interesting, but I came here specifically for my advisor.
What is the difference between translating and interpreting? Let's just start there.
All right. So the short version is that translation is written and interpreting is spoken or signed. I can't categorically say that there is no ASL translation. I know some people speak about translation as like transcribing signed videos into English, for example. So I don't know really what the translation dynamic is there. But I do know that in Spanish English, if you get a text and then you deliver a text, that is translation. If you are at a medical appointment, which is what I did a lot in DC, somebody speaks and you repeat it, and then somebody else speaks and you repeat it, that's interpreting. And there's, I guess, like the hazy part comes in when you have a document, you're given a document, and then you translate it aloud. So that can either be sites translation or it can be text interpretation. There's interpreters do that work. There's never like one complete straight answer, but that's the short answer is translation is written and interpreting is spoken or signed. And there are different skills. In translation, you have the time to get a dictionary or friend or really like research down the line to see how this specific term was used over the years. And in interpretation, you can't.
In DC, you must have encountered lots of different varieties of Spanish, right? Versus, I mean, being in Spain, you probably still encounter some, but actually, are you medically interpreting at all in Spain? Probably not, right?
I'm not medically interpreting in Spain. First off, this year has been weird. Secondly, I'm not interpreting as much right now because interpreting is live, whereas translation, like, I can do it at night or I can do it at any point. So interpreting would require me to, I don't know, skip seminars or put off work that I need to do for the PhD. So the PhD comes first and I'm also translating on the side rather than interpreting and then arranging my life around my interpreting.
You must have encountered a lot of different varieties of Spanish when you were in DC. What was that like?
Yeah, I feel like the majority Spanish spoken in DC is Salvadoran,
okay.
Just because of migration patterns, I guess. You actually know this, Megan. I went over to Tucson a couple of years ago over the summer to do a training for court interpreters, and that was a very different Spanish that they were not really teaching us. They weren't teaching us Spanish, right? But the Spanish that they were using was very different than the words that they were telling us that we should be using for the English terms was very different because, I mean, in Tucson, most of the Spanish spoken is Mexican. But yeah, so in DC, it's primarily Salvadoran, and that's sort of what I think of when I think of the Spanish that I speak in the United States. I think of this like Spain and Salvadoran mix, and that's not what most people would think of at all.
So are you Spanish?
I am Spanish, yep. So I moved to the US when I was 13.
Okay. So just going off of Carrie's question, since she brought up different varieties of Spanish, is it ever actually a problem? Because I'm just thinking it's more lexical.
I guess like the issues that I could encounter is the fact that I use the vosotros form. Like that's what I grew up with. That's what makes sense to me. But I would try to use ustedes for two reasons. One, so that, I mean, people can absolutely understand it, but so that they didn't focus as much on what I was saying. And also out of respect, it feels like vosotros is a bit like tú, and if you're my patient, like I should always call you usted.
And just in case people don't know, what's the difference between tú and usted?
For me, right, in Spain, for example, we have a difference between tú and usted, which are they're second person pronouns, second person singular pronouns. And then vosotros and ustedes, which are second person plural pronouns. This is very hard to say in English.
Yeah.
Wow. I usually say this in Spanish. Tú and vosotros, vosotras, vosotres would be more informal. And then to me, the Spanish that I speak, usted and ustedes would be formal. But then there's other Spanish-speaking countries that only have usted and ustedes. Some that have tú but only have ustedes. There's Argentina, Uruguay. There's actually a lot of places. Even in Chile, in some places of Chile, they have vos for the singular. I think these are all understandable by everyone. It's just not something that you can necessarily produce accurately yourself if you don't use it, because it's an entirely different conjugation. So I would use ustedes instead of vosotros, even though they would completely understand me, but I guess it made them more at ease and it didn't make them like ask me about it, which would happen. So that would be like more than the lexical problems, which maybe it came up twice and I said what, you know, then you interrupted. Like the proper thing to say is to speak about yourself in the third person, because you're not saying what the doctor said. You're saying, so the interpreter needs clarification. What do you mean this thing? But that was very rare. The issue that happened the most would be people, my patients, because they were the ones who spoke Spanish, who would make small talk or interrupt me to say that I spoke Spanish really well. It's not because they thought I wouldn't, but because there's this weird reverence towards being Spanish. So it was like, you speak the correct Spanish and I speak wrong. Like you I had this talk with a lot of patients. So like, you absolutely do not speak wrong. It's like, well, no, like I should learn how to. No, so you're great.
Oh, that makes me so sad.
Right.
Oh, because I'm not surprised that they feel that way. I'm surprised that it came up during some sort of medical visit. Well, I'd ask my dad, like, how do you say this in Spanish? He's like, well, I'm probably wrong, but here it is. I'm like, you speak Spanish. Ever since you came out of the womb, you know, have been hearing Spanish. Well, and in the third trimester, you know, like, how could you be wrong? What are people picking up on that they know that your Spanish is Spain Spanish?
Definitely the accent, because I have the the sound. If vosotres came out, they would also know it there. A word that I'm sure came up would be beans, which we say beans in English and we know very quickly, but like there's hundreds of words for beans. Like, even in Spain, we have, like, habas, habichuelas, judías. I don't know. There's a lot of them. You have, like, frijoles in Mexico. So there's, like, a lot of them. And that I know came up because I also did nutritionist appointments. So there they would definitely be able to pinpoint.
How funny.
That's fascinating.
Oh, I was like, beans are just frijoles. Like, what are you talking about? So interesting. Yeah, I could talk about beans all day. So we should probably, like,
move on from the bean discourse.
Yeah, before I get into this too much. So what does it mean to be certified as a interpreter or translator?
Well, there are different processes. So for translation, I believe there is only one certifying body in the U.S., and that is the American Translators Association. And for that, you take an exam. It's a written exam. It used to be all handwritten, but now there's also a computer option. And they give you a couple of different texts, and you need to translate them, and then somebody would grade them. Usually it's two people who grade it, and then if they agree, then that's fine. And if they don't agree, they bring in a third grader, and there's a score, and it's pass-fail. For the interpreting part, there's two national U.S. certifying bodies, and they are CCHI, which is mine, which is the Certification Commission for Healthcare Interpreters, and there's CMI, which is something similar for medical interpreters rather than healthcare. And both of those exams are very, very similar. There's a first part, which everybody of all languages can take. So even if you speak one that there's no full exam for, you can go and take this part, and it's a multiple choice question, like, what does a triage nurse do? So just to make sure that you know medical stuff. And then for Spanish, obviously, there's a more advanced exam. So if you pass that, you go and take a second exam, and that's pre-recorded, and you have to interpret into the computer, like, a couple of different scenes.
We've talked about it before on the show. We have a crisis in the U.S., of course, always, but when it comes to medical and court interpretation, because of all the migrants that are here now and have always been, but if they get access to interpretation, it might be with someone who's not certified. Do you think that that's a problem?
Absolutely. So, I mean, one part is pretty much every migrant child in the U.S. has interpreted as a child.
Yeah,
like, we have
absolutely
all done it because nobody else would. I've even, like, interpreted, not as a child, but as a teen, for Italian, and I don't speak Italian, but, like, nobody else will help this person unless I do. And that is a real thing that it happens. It should not happen. Like, we should have the tools for people to understand each other without that happening. So that's the first part. Second part is, for a lot of minoritized languages, there are no trained interpreters, or there's groups of interpreters that are starting to train other people, even if they don't speak the same language, but give them the tools in order to interpret, which is also very important work. Community interpreting, like social or language justice movements, are also really important. But yeah, for a language like Spanish, like Mandarin, like Arabic, which there are a lot of people that speak this language, we should definitely be going to certified interpreters and translators, because a very small error can have huge consequences. And those huge consequences could be your insurance claim is denied because your name is misspelled. And that's also like a clerical error. But if you express this name wrong, that can be an error there. Or it could be, I had this one patient who did not know that they had diabetes, because their interpreters in the past had just said, like, you eat a lot of sugar.
Oh, like, that's, wow.
That's not what it is. Wow. But so they just... I'm also, like, really frustrated by this one because it's diabetes. Like,
it's like, so easy.
Word, right? But so their interpreters didn't know, and they just said, like, you eat too much sugar, or you have too much sugar. And they just did not know that they had diabetes, and this is treatable, and they need to be taking these steps. A child wouldn't know that. Like, a child has no reason to know what diabetes is, but an interpreter should.
Right. Absolutely.
And, like, I don't think that anyone chooses to do wrong in this situation at all. Because it's the same thing that I said. Like, I helped in Italian because literally nobody else would, because there was no other solution. But I very probably messed up because I don't know Italian.
Yeah, absolutely. You must have.
right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And then also at this point, like when you are a child, a teenager, and like not a trained interpreter, you don't really know some of these dynamics that need to happen, right? So what I was saying about speaking about yourself in the third person, if the doctor asks something and then I immediately say like, oh, what does this mean? Then they don't know that it's me, the interpreter, saying it, for example. Or if the, I'm saying the doctor because this is what I kept doing, right? But like if the doctor misgenders your patient, you need to misgender your patient, and that is very violent, and you can speak about it with the patient afterward. You can maybe, depending on the situation, like interrupt and go like, hey, as the interpreter, this patient is male, female, non-binary, whatever. But you need to do it, because if you don't do it, like if you don't let the patient know that their doctor is racist, is a misogynist, is whatever, then you're putting that patient at risk. But we as people don't want to do that, right? Like, I don't want to misgender anyone. on my own accord, I would not. Right, so it makes sense that if you're not a trained interpreter, you would opt not to do, like, you're not doing harm, right? But, like, not to pass on this harm that is happening.
So that's perfect transition to, can you tell us what it means to be a queer translator, interpreter? What is queer translation and interpretation?
So queer translation and interpretation is a specialized subfield of translation and interpretation in the same way that medical is or legal is. A lot of us have different specializations. Some of them go deeper and some of them don't. Like, I would absolutely not be able to tell you to translate something about tempering chocolate, right? Like, I have no idea about how to temper chocolate. And that is okay. And I feel like it's not a bad thing to not be able to do trans and queer interpretation, but I feel like there's some shame from people about that. But it is definitely, definitely specialized because... So an example of an error that I see a lot is singular they, which a lot of people have discussed in the podcast before. I will tell you all to just listen to Kirby's episode and come back here. So like singular they will frequently get translated into Spanish as like plural, and then also in a binary way, frequently in the masculine. So for example, Asia Kate Dillon has a character in this show Billions, and they introduce themselves as, I don't even remember their name, the character name, but my pronouns are they, them, theirs. And in this Spain version, this is dubbed as mis palabras son ellos de ellos y a ellos, something like that. So like my words are plural men, of plural men, and toward plural men. There's a huge misunderstanding here of what these pronouns are doing. Like, they're not words, and they're also not plural. And there's just a lot of errors here, which, again, I don't think we're done with any malice. I don't think anyone wanted to erase anything. They just did not understand that singular they is a pronoun. There's also One Day at a Time. I've spoken about this show a couple of times.
I was going to ask you.
Yeah.
Tuzer with love.
Tuzer with love. Like, also, I should say, like, more fun things about translation and interpretation. This is also some more fun colonialist stuff. There's frequently different versions of media translations, right? So usually a show will get translated for dubbing and for subbing, but then it gets dubbing and subbing for Spain, and then dubbing and subbing for the rest of Spanish-speaking world, which means that usually we get four translations, which is good for me if I want to analyze translations, but it's also some weird dynamics there. But so Tuzer with love. So there's two non-binary pronouns in, or two non-binary people in this specific episode, and there's a couple of different jokes, which are great jokes. Like, this is a great show and a great episode for non-binary people to watch. It's not jokes at the expense of non-binary people, but these are like jokes that hinge on four pronouns, at least four different pronouns. So he, she, they, and ze. And this was translated into Spanish. The Spain dub is amazing. The Spain sub follows the dub for some reason. I guess like that they just decided to follow it in this one episode. And they opt to use two different neopronouns. And sorry, two different neomorphemes. And neomorphemes is what I am calling this E ending, or E, English E, Spanish A, or the X, or any other morpheme, like thing that you could put in the place where a gender morpheme would go in Spanish. So the translation uses two different neomorphemes, and they use E, like English E, Spanish A, and Spanish E, so English I. Yes. The E.
Yes.
I'm so sorry that English is so messed
that
up.
That was beautiful. That was... English vowels can go to vowels.
God damn that great vowel shift.
But so in Spanish, it's expressed in the same way, and then they preserve the joke, right? Like they have el, ella, ella, y ella, and that's great. The Latin American versions, I don't remember which is which, but they both like the dubbing and the subbing, do it wrong. And they call the person who uses they call them plural female because they're reading this person as female because the actress is actually female. So it's ellas, they say las dos y ellas, which is like the two of them, which is even weirder.
What?
Huh,
interesting.
Referring to this one
referring
character?
To this one character. So like this is the dubbing because I memorized this part. Like, me llamo Sid, las dos y ellas son mis pronombres. Those are also not, I mean, I guess they're pronouns really, but those are not gender pronouns. And what do you mean las dos? And then for the other person, they just like shove the neopronouns, the Z here, into Spanish. So it's like, so se va a no sé dónde. It's like, se isn't, it's not a pronoun. That's not how pronouns work in Spanish. You can just say va, like it makes no sense. And again, like I don't assume malice, but they just did not understand what these pronouns were doing. You needed a translator who was specialized in queer terminology. It doesn't need to be a queer translator, but it needs to be a translator who specializes in queer translation.
Okay, so that's where you might come in then and be able to help with the translation of this. So someone who specializes in queer translation interpretation could help out in this scenario.
Yeah, absolutely. I personally have not done audiovisual translation, so for media, but I have several colleagues who have, and I'm not really up to date on all of the series that are being translated into Latin American Spanish because I'm in Spain now and I am region locked into Spain. But in Spain, things are going pretty well. I feel like people are becoming more and more aware, and there's been several different translations coming out in the past couple of years that incorporate this ella in it. I'm saying ella because it's easier than saying E-I-A. So ella with... So, for example, the new Star Trek has a non-binary character who is translated in the dub and in the sub as using ella. There's this series on HBO that's called We Are Here, which includes it has some drag queens, but also some non-binary drag queens, and both the subtitles and the overlapped voices use ella, which is also really great. So there's more awareness happening, at least in Spain.
Thinking about the point you brought up earlier, in medical translation, you don't want to misgender someone, right? So this is not something where you'd have to be a queer translator interpreter. This is something that you would want all translators interpreters to know about, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because that's what the original message says. So I hear a lot of, well, that's not proper Spanish, that's not, we're used to this stuff, right? Like, that's not correct, that's not in the dictionary, I can't use it. And I mean, first of all, there's a lot of things that aren't in the dictionary that you are using. But secondly, that is what the original is saying. When the original uses singular they for a person, specifically in the context of like these people who we know are non-binary, you cannot misgender them in the translation. That's not what it's saying. And I think it's very harmful and it's very hurtful when you see a work that there's been all of this, like all this effort into it. There's an entire team that's made sure to include a non-binary character, and then it's just completely erased in the translation.
Are you someone who like does types of workshops that might help other interpreters when it comes to these kind of queer issues and how to not misgender?
Yeah, so I do both. I do consultation, sensitivity, reading. Like I would be open to audiovisual translation even though I've never done it, but I don't need to. I can just help you with your individual translation, right? But I can review all of this work to make sure that it is correct. I've done this for a couple of literary works as well. And then I do also do classes or workshops, I guess, not classes. It's always been one-offs, but I've done workshops several times about this as well. And I mean, I want to help. I want people to use this language, or not this language, to speak about us correctly and in a culturally accurate way. You don't need to make it up. Like, we are already, non-binary people are already speaking. You just need to know how we're doing it.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And you mentioned sensitivity reader. Can you just tell us what that is real quick before we move on?
Sensitivity reading is essentially like, it's like editing, it's like proofreading, except you're not really looking for commas, you're looking for issues with how you treat a subject, right? So I specifically do trans and queer sensitivity reading, there's disability sensitivity readers. And one of the examples that I could come up, like one of the examples that I'll give you from one of the works that I've done is there was a translation of a trans character who binds their chest. And the translator was an amazing translator and the editor was also great. Everybody was great, but they completely missed what bound meant. So they translated this as like, they felt that their chest was tied down or chained down. I don't remember what they said. So then as I read this, I was reading the translation first and then I was going to go back to the English, and just reading the translation, like their chest is chained down. This makes absolutely no sense. Let me look back to, oh, of course. Okay. So their chest is bound. Here's what bound means. This is what a binder does. And like, this is my proposed translation to fix this. You can take it or leave it. Like, I'm not the translator, but here's what this piece of cultural information means that they would have entirely missed because they're just not a part of it.
Yeah, that's so, so important. And you're also, you do that, like people could reach out to you if they're writing something, a novel or whatever, or an essay or something, and have you do this kind of sensitivity reading if they have a trans or queer character.
Yes, absolutely.
I actually have never heard these terms before, and I think it's really interesting. So what is the difference between indirect non-binary language and direct non-binary language?
So I needed terms like these to do my research, and they just didn't exist, so I made them up. And so when I speak non-binary language, I don't necessarily mean only non-binary people. I mean ways that are not only male or only female in language, right? So this could mean how you speak about a group of people, like a mixed group of people of different genders, or it could mean how you speak about a non-binary person, how you speak about an unspecified reader, like all of these different ways that are just skipping generally the generic masculine that people use a lot.
Is it how like I've dropped you guys and picked up y'all?
I would definitely like include that in my research of non-binary language. Yes. And it doesn't, again, it doesn't, you can use y'all for a group of men and women, or even for a group of men. And I would still count this as non-binary language because it is outside of the binary male, female. But so I further divided this into two things, into direct and indirect. So indirect is like a way, it's finding a way within traditional Spanish, within what the dictionary says, to not gender somebody. Or I speak about Spanish, but it's actually, this also exists in English, it exists in all languages, right? So like finding a way that follows the traditional rules to not gender somebody. So instead of saying he or she, or even saying they, saying the patient, right? Like this would also avoid singular they, even though singular they is perfectly grammatical, but not gendering them at all. Versus direct non-binary language, which would include neopronouns, and in Spanish, all the A or X terminations. And it is not traditional. It is grammatical because we all say it is grammatical, right? But it is a way of speaking and writing and signing that some people don't like as much. So indirect is sort of safer, and direct makes this explicit. And indirect can be used to exert violence as well. And I think this is you know, I say that it's indirect non-binary language, and of course it's non-binary, so it's inclusive. It's not. As I said, non-binary just means like outside of the dichotomy, right? So the example that I speak about a lot is Danica Roem, who is an elected representative in Virginia, or was. I actually just realized that I didn't check the last election, but I believe she still is. But she is a trans woman. And when she was elected, up until she was elected in the, you know, whenever they had their meetings of representatives of Virginia, they would say like the gentleman from so-and-so and the gentlewoman from so-and-so. And when she was elected, the GOP had a real quick meeting to say that instead of the gentleman, the gentlewoman, they were going to say the delegate from. Why did they do this? Because they didn't want to gender a trans woman correctly.
Right.
So,
I mean, in case the listeners don't know, I mean, obviously they should have said gentlewoman.
Correct.
So this is why
or,
it's violent.
Yeah.
They should have changed it to delegate a long time ago, because I think actually that's a little better.
I think
it's actually better, yeah, for everybody. However, the reason that they did it was bad, mm-hmm. so.
Right. So, I mean, Danica Roem is a frigging class act, and she said that this is good, and it means that non-binary people in the future will be included. Like, she
right.
is amazing, but
yeah, she is amazing.
She is a woman, and the reason why they changed this right then was a transphobic reason. So indirect can absolutely be used to exert violence in the same way that direct could be if they had opted to speak about Danica Roem as with singular they, that would also be violent because that is not her pronoun, that is not her grammatical gender.
So you've mentioned it throughout our chat already, but can you tell us what non-binary Spanish is sounding and looking like these days?
Let me start with the looking like. As we might know, I'm not going to assume that everybody knows, generally in Spanish, an A, like the gender morpheme A, would mean that somebody is female or that a subject is female. Actually, a subject, because in Spanish everything has a gender. My table has a gender and it is female because es una mesa. I didn't choose this gender, it just linguistically is a table and it is female. So A would mean female. And then O, or a null morpheme, and sometimes an E, depending, means masculine, right? So señor doesn't really end in a morpheme, but we know that it's contraposed with señora, so of course it's masculine. As I said, sometimes an E, I'm just going to say this in Spanish. Sometimes an E, right? So señores is masculine as well. This happens sometimes, but also sometimes an E will be neutral in traditional Spanish. So for example, estudiante, right? Like a student, estudiante is always neutral because it has always been so. This estudiante itself, like, it does not have a gender morpheme, but it would still have a grammatical gender in that if you add an article, if you add an adjective, it would have to match with it, right? So if this is a male student, it would be un estudiante. If it's female, it would be una. This E that is sometimes neutral is also used as one of the neomorphemes. The neomorpheme that is most in use definitely in Spain, and I feel like in most Spanish-speaking countries. So this is one of the primary ones. The other primary one would be X, which we know from Latinx. And I see that a lot in the US, and I see it mostly in writing. And a lot of people, including myself, will actually pronounce it A. So whenever I encounter any non-vowel in the place of a gender morpheme, I actually pronounce it A. So Latinx is my exception because Latinx is a word on its own, right? If it said un ex estudiante, I would say un estudiante. But this, there's the other two vowels, like I and U, are also used by the, but this is minority. There's other characters that are also being used, but generally the E and the X are being used instead of the traditional gender morphemes.
I will write X a lot. So I'll say Latinx. And I mean, I don't often speak Spanish, but I would too then use E if I saw. So I think that's a thing too where I'm like, okay, I always write the X, but I've started adding the E because, you know, listening to folks. And also, like, oh yeah, I mean, if I were to speak Spanish, I would actually use that eh instead. So it's really interesting that that's appearing that way. And I think that there are a lot of people that do that, probably. I don't think it's like an isolated incident.
The pronouncing it as eh? Yeah, like I've seen it in a lot of different places.
Yeah, when you have the X. Yeah. Yeah, so having the X in writing, perhaps, and then in saying eh.
I usually recommend that if you want to use the X, I mean, obviously use whatever you want. I'm not going to tell anyone what to use. I personally always use A because it is, the X is not accessible for screen readers. So screen readers aren't magic, right? Screen readers don't know what a word actually means. They don't know how to pronounce a word. They just know these letters sound this way. So when they found an E, an I, an U, like one of the three vowels, they know how to pronounce it. But when they find the next, they don't, they stutter. They don't know, like amigue would be like amix or something. And they just, the screen readers don't know. They're just programs. So I use the A all the time. It's not an accessibility issue when you use the X, say, in a poster that you print out, or it's a different kind of accessibility issue, right? Blind people still don't have access to this poster that you're printing out. But generally, if it's text that a computer will read, I always use A, with the very exception of Latinx.
That is really, really good to know, and I really appreciate it. I know you've told me before, and I'm just remembering why I added the E, but I'm wondering, would screen readers have a problem with someone putting X and then slash E?
It would.
It probably would. There is a free screen reader program. Hold on, let me check what it's called, because I have it. It's NVDA. It's free. You can and should donate, actually, because this is obviously designed for blind people. But you can download it and use it to see how accessible something is, which can definitely include
tweets
or your website. I've actually been working on the accessibility of my website the past couple of months, so it's also been really useful.
By the way, fantastic. I noted that last. I was like, this is a fantastically accessible website. Like, I really, I'm going to do that to my website too, so thank you.
I have like a Medium post in drafts about what I've been doing, because I've been learning a lot, and this information is definitely out there, but it's not bad to compile it. You know, things like contrast as well, like I changed the colors in my website a lot, because before it sort of worked, but the contrast, according to the tools that checked the contrast, was terrible, so I changed that. And yeah, there's a lot of different things that I've been learning about it.
What can all of us say to people who say that queer or non-binary language or whatever is changing too quickly? And so what's even the point of trying to keep up?
I don't think it's changing too quickly at all. So the earliest usage that I've been able to find of A is from 1976. And I mean, it was definitely not mainstream then. It was also not mainstream when I was a kid, but when I was a kid, I was using it. I didn't find the 76 until very recently, right? But the A makes instinctive sense. And I coined it, like a lot of different people have coined it in many different places over the years. The difference here is that now it is mainstream, and now it's showing up in our Netflix queue, and now newspapers are talking about it, right? But it's not changing quickly at all. I feel it's also pretty stable, specifically particularly in Spanish, just because it's really just switching out a morpheme for another one. You're fine.
Yeah,
it's pretty really simple. Quick and easy.
Right.
What is changing sort of quickly, not necessarily like all that quickly, but okay, it is changing, are the specific terms, right? So a couple of weeks ago, I was actually talking about how when I was a kid, I said that I was androgynous and I said that I was genderqueer, because these were the two words that existed that were accessible. And now I say I'm non-binary, and I don't really say, I'm definitely not androgynous by my description. I mean, I don't use genderqueer. I don't mind the word, but that's not what I use. But those were the words that existed, and now they have changed. So it is true that some words are changing. This isn't new, but it is true that we do not use transsexual at all. We use trans, we use transgender. So there is some lexical change.
I just wonder if people who are privileged and not have had to think about these things just think it's moving fast because it's moving fast for them. Like, suddenly it's introduced to them, they're like, oh, now I have to keep up? Like, that's one of the biggest things I see. And I'm like, you're just being an asshole. Like, it's simple as that.
There's an outrageous amount of articles, both like academic articles and newspaper articles and blog posts, an outrageous amount of them, that say that the A was coined in 2015 by some woman in the US.
Oh, God.
And now there's like a new group of them that are saying it was coined in 2018 in Argentina in the abortion protest. And that's not true. Again, like, I was using it in high school. Right? So not everybody who needed it knew that it existed or coined it themselves, right? But a lot of people who needed it for ourselves have been using it for literal decades, and they just didn't know. So I think that it's that, like, people are now learning these words and they're hearing them for the first time, or words and grammatical structures and whatever else. And it's fast to them, but it's been around.
I mean, ultimately, the message is don't be an asshole and use people's pronouns. Like, or don't be an asshole, period. Use people's pronouns, period.
Ambiguity.
Yeah, I know, right? And I wanted to make sure that was not ambiguous. Although everyone who listens to this knows how I feel about it, but it's really important.
I do have a tip for people who want to use more direct non-binary language, or indirect also, like in Spanish and English and whichever language, which is call your pet, like decide that your pet is non-binary now, and just speak to your pet, speak about your pet.
Oh.
Your pet doesn't care, like, your pet doesn't actually have a gender. I'm really sorry to break this to you. Pets do not care about human genders.
No.
And your pet is not going to be offended if you misgender them at all. And if you don't have a pet, call your plant something, like, decide that you're going to speak about something in your life and just do it. Because it really is about practice.
I love that so much. I love that. What can privileged people do when... Is there helpful things that we can do when we see people saying, like, they is, I can't do that because it's ungrammatical, or Latinx is, you know, ruining the Spanish language?
I don't know. This is a hard question because, like, honestly, nowadays my strategy on Twitter is to block everyone.
Yeah, me too. I mean, right, like, I've been doing for a long time.
Yeah.
Like, I come in here to talk to my friends, and I don't come in here to fight with strangers, right? So the people who straight up are, like, mocking it or saying that it's terrible or saying ridiculous things, like, there's, I don't know if there's that much of a point with engaging with them, which sucks, and we should be able to talk about these things, but particularly in a forum such as Twitter, like, they're not going to listen, they're going to just retweet you and make fun of you, like, they're not, that's not going to really be productive. If it's somebody in your environment, like, if it's, I was going to say somebody in your neighborhood, but we are all pretty COVID right now.
Yeah.
So
what if it's your racist Theo,
then yeah. I mean, then you can talk about, one of the things is it really doesn't matter what binary people feel about non-binary language, right? Because there's non-binary people who exist, and I mean, this is who we are, and we need to express ourselves in some way. This comes up a lot in Spanish because grammatical gender is everywhere. It doesn't come up as much in English because you can avoid it easier. But yeah, so point one is it doesn't matter as much. You just need to speak about us as we ask you to, and that's that. But yeah, like, speaking about the fact that there's people who exist who are non-binary, and it's okay to speak about them in some way and respect them. I think one of the things that I've been saying lately is that it's okay if you don't want to use ella or ellix or whatever all the time. You don't need to. I am not asking you to suddenly speak, like, use todes and only speak about people in a neutral way. I am not. I'm asking you to speak about non-binary people with non-binary language. In the same way that in Spanish, there's, particularly in feminist circles, there's a tendency to use a generic feminine rather than a generic masculine. So even if there's, right, in Spanish, if there's 100 women and one man, then you need to speak in the masculine, because that's, you traditionally need to speak in the masculine, the generic masculine. So shifting that and saying, like, hey, this is a feminist space, and there's 3 women and one man, and we're going to speak in the feminine, or even, like, there's 1 woman and 3 men, or even there's all men, but this is a feminist space, so we're going to speak about the feminine, like, just this generic feminine. You don't need to use this generic feminine to speak about women in the feminine, because they are women and that's their gender. So in the same way, you don't need to use non-binary language all the time. You just need to use it when you speak about us.
Yeah. Punto.
I think that there's definitely, like, I don't know, like, a defense mechanism too. Like, there's this change, right? Like, we've already said that there's this change that I didn't know. So to me, it's a completely new thing. Everybody's using it. I don't know how to use it. Everyone's calling me a transphobe. I don't like it. I mean, that sucks. I understand that frustration. There's definitely a frustration there of like, I don't understand this. It would be great if everybody could learn how to use this immediately and they were okay with it immediately, in the same way that it would be great if nobody was racist ever again. You need to take a step and then take more. Depending on the person and depending on the context, you might be able to give them more steps to follow, but it could be easy to just say, like, when you speak about this one person, you do this, or whatever, you know, like, take this one step, and then maybe you can take more of it. Like, right now, let's address this direct harm that you're exerting on this one person.
A difference between being okay with it and a difference between having to practice and sometimes messing up. We're all human, and we're going to make mistakes.
You can also look at it like a challenge. Like, it is a little bit like learning a new accent, or like learning... I say it's a lot like if I had to start using the voseo right now. Like, I don't know how to use the voseo. I can make it up, but I don't know how to use it properly. So there is some learning that and some rewiring that needs to happen. Take it as a challenge. Like, hey, I'm going to learn a new accent. I'm going to learn a new thing. Like, I'm going to learn how to use this, even though I don't know anyone, even though I'm not going to use it ever outside the house. And I'm going to call my pet this and see how it goes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wanted to plug one person,
yeah.
And that is Chris Nicely, Dr. Chris Nicely, who is sort of like my tag team person right now on Twitter, because they research non-binary French. They also look into trans and queer pedagogies and how to, you know, actually include queer and trans people beyond this one day when you discuss gender in class, right? So like how to include us always.
Well, Carrie, what do we do?
We always tell our listeners, don't be an asshole.
Don't be an asshole.
Don't be an asshole.
Yay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So this month we would like to thank our newest patrons on patreon.com. Ruby Lewis.
Yay.
Jesse Albatrosov. I hope I said that right. I probably fucked up the stress. Albatrosov. Oh. Anyway, thank you, Jesse. And Cynthia Gayton.
Yay. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. The Vocal Fries podcast is produced by me, Carrie Gillen, for Halftone Audio. Theme music by Nick Granum. You can find us on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Vocal Fries Pod. You can email us at vocalfriespod@gmail.com, and our website is vocalfriespod.com.